You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Stephen Hubbell of the Open Society Fellowship Program. When Chris Segoyan was chosen as an Open Society Fellow in the spring of 2011, the dimensions of the U.S. government surveillance program, which is directed at U.S. citizens, foreign nationals, and also, as we now know, at foreign heads of state, and the complicity, the cooperation of the major tech companies in enabling that surveillance was not well understood. Chris, at the time, was one of the very few technologists in the United States who was studying precisely what happened when the U.S. government requested tech companies, telecom providers, to provide surveillance data on individuals. Early in his fellowship, Chris made it his business to elevate the knowledge, to educate this organization, the Open Society Foundations, about the looming danger that this nascent alliance between the private and public sector posed to civil liberties. It fell to him to tell scary stories, as it were, about just how badly our freedoms may be threatened by this alliance. Some of you may remember a memorable brown bag discussion in September of 2011, because some of you were there, at which Chris told a number of stories that were frightening indeed, that illustrated the dangers in a very precise, granular level that might lie in wait for us. Now, Chris is an effective communicator. You gave an excellent performance. But I think I speak for many of us when I said that as sobering as we found that meeting, we walked away. I mean, we deal with frightening scenarios almost every day in our work. And I think that surveillance crested somewhere toward the middle of the pack, even after your performance, even after your lecture. Now, of course, we have the revelations contained in Edward Snowden's archive. The rest, as we know, is history. Listening to that podcast now has an almost surreal effect, like that old Twilight Zone episode where a car radio only plays songs and programs from 1925. So far have we traveled as a society in coming to terms and in an odd way accepting the dimensions of the surveillance program. Back to bring us up to speed, I'm delighted to welcome Chris Segoyan back here. Chris is the principal technologist at the American Civil Liberties Union Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, as well as a visiting fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. He is also one of the leading privacy experts in the United States, so it's my pleasure to welcome him back. Chris.
Thank you all for coming. This is a packed room. I greatly appreciate your time, and I will try and make the 15 or 20 minutes that I talk, and then followed by questions, as informative and scary but understandable as possible. We've learned a lot in the past year. We've learned an awful lot. For people like me who live and breathe surveillance, it has been an extremely difficult job just to keep up with what seems like an endless stream of detailed information about the scope of government surveillance. For those of you who do not live and breathe surveillance, I'm sure at a certain point, probably fairly on in the process, you gave up trying to absorb all of the new material. Maybe you feel overwhelmed, or maybe some of it is just very, very technically complex. My hope is to try and to explain some of the more important aspects to what has come out in the last 6 to 8 months, and to help tell a story about how this government, our government, is dealing with fundamental changes in technology that are impacting its ability to do what it wants. And I'm not going to take a position on whether I think the surveillance is good or bad. You can probably guess where I fall on that issue. But what I really want you to do is just to understand what's happening and how the government is changing its tactics. So the telephone companies in the United States, the AT&Ts and Verizons, and before they got split up, it was just the AT&T, they've been in the surveillance business for more than 100 years. The first wiretaps in this country were in about 1895. They were in New York. They were down at the Customs Building, down on the southern end of Manhattan. From that building, the police could tap any phone in the city. This feature, this capability, was kept a secret from the public for about 15 years, and it wasn't until a high-profile scandal that then the existence of this capability was revealed. It wasn't until, I think, 1928 that the first wiretapping case made its way to the Supreme Court, what is known as the Olmstead case, in which the government was recording a bootlegger who was smuggling rum through Seattle. And so these companies, the telephone companies, have been providing surveillance assistance for so long that they're actually quite comfortable with their role in the ecosystem. The telephone companies are heavily regulated. Their existence depends upon a license by the FCC. The companies that operate wireless telephone service rely on spectrum that's allocated or actually sold to them in an auction by the FCC. And in addition to that aspect, they also have extensive government contracts. All of the telephone lines and services, the classified networks that they operate, these companies make a lot of money from the government. And so in general, the phone companies are pretty comfortable with their role in the surveillance ecosystem. They just didn't want it to be advertised. As long as there weren't stories on the front page, they weren't really too bothered. In many cases, what we've learned in the past year or so is that in the months that followed 9/11, in fact, many of them volunteered to provide assistance. They didn't wait for the government to come to them with a court order. They said, how can we help? What information can we provide? And so 20 years ago, even maybe 5 years ago, the phone companies were a one-stop shop for surveillance. The phone companies, particularly in the mobile era, the phone companies know where you are, where you were. They know who you communicate with. They know how often you communicate with them. That, in fact, then reveals information about your social network and the hierarchy, who is more important to you, who is less important to you. The people who, if someone calls you at 2 in the morning and you pick up the phone, that person is important in your life. And if you ignore their calls, they're not that important in your life. The phone companies know which web pages you're looking at from your cell phone. They know the telephone companies that provide broadband internet service at your house know what you're looking at on your computer from home. They know what you're searching for. They know when you're looking at the web page of Planned Parenthood or Alcoholics Anonymous. They know who you're emailing. They can look in the emails in many cases. They know which videos you're looking at on YouTube. They have a great amount of information about your lives that just simply wasn't possible 50 or 100 years ago. So the fact that these companies, who were so tightly coupled to the government, who were so willing to go out of their way to help the government, the fact that they had this wealth of information really made life quite easy for this government. Now, in addition to that, the world's communications flow through the United States. If someone in Mexico is emailing someone in Colombia, chances are the emails may pass through the United States, either because there may not be a direct internet cable between those two countries, and they may go through Miami, or in modern times today, even if there's a direct internet connection between Mexico and Colombia, everyone will be using Gmail and Yahoo, and so the communications will still flow up to the United States. And so the fact that the world was sending their data through the United States meant that the U.S. had an enviable advantage when it came to surveillance. We could tap everyone's communications when they landed on our shores. So that was the world until a few years ago, until probably 2010. And then a few things started to change. Sort of two major changes happened. One is that the Silicon Valley tech companies started to aggressively intrude into markets that were previously dominated by the phone companies. So 10 years ago, if you were a Somali immigrant and you were trying to make a telephone call to your family back home, you would go to a 7-Eleven and you would buy a calling card, and then you would call your family and friends back home because you didn't want to pay the $5 a minute that AT&T charged. Today, a Somali immigrant is far more likely to sit down either at their home or at a cyber cafe and use Skype because it's cheap or free if the recipient is also using Skype. And so communications, international communications, particularly communications to countries where the U.S. has a significant intelligence or military interest, are far more likely now to be going over internet-provided services rather than telephone-provided services. Text messaging. For years, one of the most lucrative services that the telephone companies offer. 25 cents per text message for something that costs them basically nothing to deliver. I mean, text messaging is a license to print money for the carriers. Text messaging revenue is declining as consumers shift to instant messaging-based services on their phones. Why pay for something when you can do it for free? Again, the phone companies had all of these communications, and now they are migrating to the Silicon Valley companies like Facebook or Snapchat or Skype. So bit by bit, you have the services themselves migrating. Now, that hasn't been a huge problem because many of the technology companies, although the data was now going through them, the consumer had to get on the internet first, right? So even if you were using Google or Facebook to communicate, you still had to get out to the internet. So you would be using an AT&T or Verizon connection to get onto the internet. And so as long as the NSA could tap the AT&T or Verizon connections, then they could get everything that was going over it. But the second big change, and one that started in January of 2010, was that companies like Google started to encrypt the data between their customers and the company's servers. So, I suspect that many people in this room have at some point used online banking. And when you are using your web browser to connect to your bank, you may notice that in the top left-hand corner in the browser location bar, you will see a lock icon. That is the way that your computer tells you that the connection between your computer and the bank is encrypted. It means that if you're checking your account at Starbucks, that someone sitting near you cannot see your password as you type it in and it gets sent over the network. If you're buying a book on Amazon, when you start typing in your credit card numbers, you can look and see in the top left-hand corner, the lock icon will be present. That, again, makes sure that no one can intercept your credit card numbers as they go over the internet. Okay, so starting in January of 2010, Google turned on that same encryption technology for Gmail, which meant that the communications between your computer and Google's servers were now encrypted, which meant that a wiretap performed with the help of Verizon or AT&T no longer revealed the emails. The only way for the US government to get emails sent by one Google user to another Google user as of January of 2010 was to go to Google. Google was the first big internet company to do this. And in the next 2-3 years, first it was Google, then it was Twitter, then it was Microsoft Hotmail, then Facebook, and then as of yesterday, Yahoo has now also finally joined the ranks. And what this has done, it has made it more difficult for the NSA to get at the communications of those users of those services without the help of those companies. So if you take Google, let me step back. In the weeks after the first Snowden disclosure last summer, the sort of two big programs that got the most press, one was the domestic metadata program, the collection of records about every single telephone call in the United States. That is the one that we sued over about a week after the first article. The second program that captured a lot of attention was something called PRISM, Prism captured the attention of the press because it involved Google and Facebook and Apple, and because it had a sexy name like Prism and a very cheesy Pink Floyd type logo. In the wake of the Prism disclosures, all of the tech companies said, no, you've got the wrong impression. We are not providing wholesale access to our customers' information. Yes, we will turn over information about a particular customer when the government comes to us with a individualized order, but we are not providing access to millions of people's information at once. And that's probably true. Because for many years, the government didn't need to. Because many of these companies weren't encrypting their customers' information, the U.S. government could get bulk access by going to the Verizons and the AT&Ts of the world. They could literally get access to every single email sent by every single person in the world going through one of these services because they were tapping what's called the internet backbone, the large information, the large cables that carry everything, either domestically or internationally, the undersea fiber optic cables that link one country to another. But slowly, bit by bit, it's becoming more and more difficult. It was revealed just a few months ago that even after Google turned on the encryption between the user and Google servers, that the NSA and their partner, the GCHQ, the British intelligence agency, were actually tapping the connections between Google's offices. So the connection between your computer and Google was encrypted, but Google was not encrypting the connection between its own offices, and so GCHQ was able to tap those. Within days after the Washington Post published that information, Google announced that they were now encrypting those connections, and Microsoft and Yahoo have followed in similar announcements. So what does this mean? There's a lot of technology here, but the part that I want you to understand is that there are two forms of surveillance. There's targeted surveillance. The government is interested in person X. They think that person X is doing something bad, or person X is a foreign leader, or person X is just some kind of person of interest. And they go to a company and they say, give us a copy of that person's emails. That is one form of targeted surveillance. But another form of surveillance basically involves dragnets and then searching. So if the government wanted to obtain the emails of everyone who mentioned a particular word in an email, that is something that they cannot do without collecting everyone's information. That's what they've been doing for the last few years. One of the most problematic surveillance programs that we've learned about that hasn't captured the press because, unfortunately, it didn't have a particularly sexy name. In fact, it has the worst and most boring name ever, is what are called about searches. So again, it's such a boring name, but it really deserves to be on the front page of the newspaper. But what we've learned is that NSA will search every single email they've collected for a particular name or email address. That doesn't mean that if Bipasha is a target that they will look for the emails that Bipasha is sending to me. They will search Steve's emails for Bipasha's email address. If Steve and I are emailing each other, they will just search for anyone else's email address that is on their list of targets, which means that they are searching through far more people's emails for things that are suspicious.
Can you tell me that again?
Again, so this is really complex. So imagine... So the NSA is collecting vast amounts of emails, mm-hmm. largely from people outside of the United States. They put all of these emails in a gigantic database, and then they look through those emails for words that are of interest, the name of a target, the email address of a target, the phone number of a target.
Okay.
Even if the email has not been sent by or to a target, if the contents of the email contains a word they're interested in, they will search through it.
Okay.
And get it out. And so what that means is people who have not done anything to warrant any kind of suspicion are having their communications mined and searched through. And the way they can do that is because they have access to all of these communications going over these undersea cables. Because the telecommunications companies, the Verizons and AT&Ts of the world, have been providing wholesale access to their networks, to the NSA. But as a result of the Snowden disclosures, the tech companies have been tightening things up. They've been encrypting their connections between their customers, between their respective data centers, And so what this is causing, it's still too early to see the impact on the government, but what is likely going to happen in the next 6 months to 2 years, unless the government can find another way of doing things, is that they will lose their ability to do dragnet keyword searches. They will still be able to go to Google and Facebook and say, this person is a really bad person. We want to see what they're doing. But they will not be able to do keyword type searches through the databases of everyone's emails or everyone's text messages. And that's a really big change. When the government has been selling these programs to the public, or they've been defending the programs in the wake of the revelations, they've been talking about their utility, about the importance of catching the bad guys. What they haven't been entirely clear with the public about, though, is the sheer scale of the surveillance and the fact that right now they do scan the communications of a lot of innocent people. Now, they say, don't worry, if you're not doing anything bad, you shouldn't have anything to worry about. But they really are sifting through the emails of a lot of innocent people to get at the bad guys. So that's one of the biggest changes that's on the horizon. And really, were it not for Snowden, the tech companies wouldn't have been pressured into making these changes. The likely response to this is probably going to be the proposal of legislation that will empower the government to force the tech companies to either provide more information or to allow bulk keyword searches of the tech companies' databases. And this is probably going to be a really big fight in the next year or two. The other big thing that's happening right now, so there was this presidential NSA review board that the president put together, a bunch of people, most of whom had either worked for this president or previous presidents, and they took a look at many of these programs, and one of the things that they said was that the domestic telephone record program should be modified. They didn't say it should be shut down, but they said that instead of the NSA having a copy of records of every telephone call that takes place in this country, they said instead the phone companies should keep those records and then the government should search through those. You are likely going to see a significant fight in the next month to 6 months over how that takes place. The NSA will want to keep that in-house. The phone companies probably don't want to be burdened with this responsibility, but it is unlikely that that program will go away. We are obviously fighting it. And just so you make, so I can make clear, when this program was first made public, the government said, don't worry, we're not listening to what you're saying. We're not listening to your calls. We're just looking at billing records. And they say, don't worry, we don't even know who is making the calls. All we're getting are telephone numbers. We don't even get the names of the people. And that's a bit of a... it's not the most honest answer. Yes, it's technically true that the database that they're keeping these things in does not list the name. It just has a telephone number. But any of you who've ever Googled a telephone number to find out who called you know that there are, in fact, reverse telephone book directories that are online. Presumably, the NSA has access to something at least as good as Google. That aside, because the government has this database of every telephone call that has been made in this country, people who are good and people who are bad, they necessarily have a database of everyone who's called an abortion clinic, everyone who's called a suicide hotline, everyone who has called a gambling line, a bookie, everyone who's called a payday loan company, 2 days before Christmas. They have in their possession a database of information that could destroy many people. There are a lot of sensitive things that are contained in those records. If you call an abortion clinic reservation or appointment line, does it really matter what time the appointment is going to be, or is the sensitive thing the fact that you're calling the telephone number to book an appointment? If you call a phone sex hotline, does it matter really what you say on that 35-minute call, or is the fact that you're making that 35-minute call enough to sink you, particularly if you are a closeted Republican politician and it is for a phone line for people with slightly non-standard interests? There is information in this database that can sink us all. And even if you take the NSA at their word, that there are strict checks and balances, that they have oversight by the FISA court, that congressional committees are reviewing this, that they have internal oversight mechanisms, they have inspectors general. We may have that now, but we may not have that in the future. Even if you trust the president that we have right now, you may not trust the president that we have in the future. And this mechanism, this gigantic surveillance apparatus, is a threat to democracy. Right? We learned in the decades after that J. Edgar Hoover and his colleagues really abused the system of surveillance that they had built. We learned afterwards that they had secretly recorded tapes of Martin Luther King cheating on his wife, and then sent recordings of that to him with a note encouraging him to commit suicide. Hoover truly abused his surveillance powers, then used it to amass power and influence those who had the ability to oversee him. This system that the NSA has now built for itself is something that Hoover would have only dreamed of. The ability to collect this much data about every search, every telephone call, everyone's location information. And there are still so many things we haven't learned. We still don't know how the NSA is monitoring financial transactions, both credit cards and wire transfers. We still don't know how they're collecting records of airplane flights or bus tickets or train tickets or other travel records or hotel stays or supermarket loyalty points. But rest assured, they probably are collecting that. Now that you've learned a little bit about how terrifying the NSA's powers are, what can you do about it? Well, it's really, really difficult to extract yourself from these databases. In our society today, we leave traces, electronic traces of our lives everywhere, right? Whether you are swiping your subway card, or whether you are texting your friends and family, when you're paying your bills, everything generates an electronic record that ends up in a database somewhere. And to extract yourself from that requires that you pay a social tax that in many cases may be too extreme. Many of you may have a friend who doesn't have a cell phone, and there are people who don't have cell phones, but they are the minority, and to include them in social events is very unpleasant. When their train is late, they have no way of letting you know. I don't use Facebook. I am one of the few people in my social circle that doesn't use Facebook. And what that means is that I don't get invited to weddings and birthday parties anymore unless my friends happen to remember that I'm the one person who they want to invite who isn't on Facebook. It's a really high price to pay to maintain some shred of privacy in 2014. I don't have a lot of good answers for you. There's not really any way that you can hide the records of who you call on your phone. There's not really any way that you can hide the records of what you spend or the merchants that you go to, except to use cash, which of course you cannot do on the internet. You can only really do for in-person transactions. The one saving grace here is that there are sort of two kinds of records that the government can get. There are the records of what you do, what's called metadata. Those are records saying this person went to this place at this time. Those records are really tough to hide. And then there's the data about what you actually do. If you're on the telephone, the contents of your conversation, that's the content, and the metadata is information about who you called. There are now a host of services that you can use to hide the contents of your communications. On my phone here, I have several apps, some free, some paid, that let me make encrypted telephone calls. My legal team, we make encrypted telephone calls among our team now. You know, we have colleagues. I have colleagues who go to Guantanamo. I have colleagues who go to foreign countries and where they're worried either about the U.S. government tapping the line or the foreign government tapping the line. And thankfully, in the last couple of years, there have been some services and tools that have been developed such that you can now make an encrypted telephone call to your spouse. You can now send an encrypted text message to your spouse or to your friends. And these weren't here a few years ago, or at least they were so difficult to use that only the truly geeky of the geeky could use them. And so they're now slowly trickling down to regular folks, and I think, you know, one of the other nice things about the Snowden disclosures is that there are a bunch of companies now that are getting into this space thinking that they can make some money on privacy. And so some of these companies offer, in fact, paid encrypted communication services. So there are a few things you can do. You can check out some of those services. A couple that exist, one that's paid, is called Silent Circle. It's about $10 a month, and you can make encrypted calls and text messages. The free, the best free versions of those are called Redphone, R-E-D-P-H-O-N-E. That's for Android. It lets you make encrypted calls. And then Text Secure, T-E-X-T-S-E-C-U-R-E. And that lets you send encrypted text messages. They're really easy to use, and actually easy enough that you can get your friends and family who care less about this stuff to use them. It's my sincere hope that these will not just be used by people of privilege, but that they will make their ways into communities of color, that into countries with truly authoritarian and repressive regimes. And some of that stuff is actually happening as a result of funding from the State Department. So the state is giving out several million dollars a year to fund the development of these tools for use in foreign countries, but we can, of course, use them here, too. So there are a few tools and services that you can use, but ultimately, hiding yourself from the databases of what you're doing and where you're going remains a very difficult problem. I don't actually have a silver bullet there. The best we have is legislative change in D.C., and if that comes at all, it will happen slowly, or change through the courts, and there also it will happen very slowly. So I'm sorry to end on a depressing note, but my email address is available online. My telephone number is also available online in databases, and I would welcome your encrypted emails and telephone calls.
Thank you, Chris. If your remarks in 2011 were sobering, I think today you've said enough to make us swear off the stuff forever. I have three questions, and we'll open it up. Question number one is, are you concerned with the threat of kind of preemptive reformism? You mentioned the White House's own efforts to, and AP was reporting this morning that Obama is considering issuing new directive to the NSA that would severely curtail its dragnet approach, its about approach. Likewise, Congress has an oversight board called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, I think, that's going to release its own recommendations. Any of these orders could presumably be rescinded without notification, without oversight, without appeal. Is that a concern? In other words, you diffuse the problem for the moment and then undo what you've done down the line. Question number two is, you know, in light of this incredible saga playing out across the river in New Jersey, in which the most vulgar and obvious and tools imaginable were used to evidently to retaliate against a politician who wouldn't sign on to the governor's re-election campaign. And clearly his operatives were behaving more or less without fear. They assumed there was no chance of being caught at all. How difficult really would it be for somebody in the government, if the circumstances were right, to use the data mine that they have on an imaginary person called Glenn Greenwald, or an imaginary person called Laura Poitras, or an imaginary person called Chris Segoyam, and to begin to filter this stuff out now through friendly channels? And you can hear there's a paranoid mindset in all this. The last question is there any danger at all in if you use Text Secure or Redphone or any of these other products that the government is going to, you know, make it a top priority to find the people who are using, because what do they have to hide? If you had nothing to hide, why would you be using Redphone?
Right. Well, so we have someone in the queue.
Sure.
Well, I just,
was like, wouldn't they have broken the encryption by now? I can't conceive they wouldn't.
I don't have so much ability to make a statement. No, no.
The danger of premature reformism or premature...
So we have some laws on the books in this country that govern the powers of the intelligence community. The main law is called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, and then it was followed up with the FISA Amendments Act in, I think, 2011 or 12. What's important to note is that those laws only govern the domestic actions of the intelligence community. So they govern when the NSA can go to an American company and demand help, or when the FBI can conduct a secret search of a U.S. house looking for information about someone engaged in foreign intelligence activities. Everything that happens outside of the United States, outside of our borders, everything that happens in space, not regulated by law at all. The only thing that governs what the NSA does outside of the United States is something called Executive Order 12333. So the thing that's been occupying the headlines a month ago, the revelation that the US government was spying on the telephone calls of Angela Merkel in Germany, this was conducted by a joint CIA-NSA unit called the Special Collections Service. They are the most Hollywood-like of the spooks. They operate out of 80 U.S. embassies and consulates around the world. At many of these embassies and consulates, there is what the Germans are calling a spy nest on the roof of the embassy. So this is some kind of building or some kind of structure with special material on the walls that allow radio waves to pass through. And there's a bunch of really, really expensive equipment on the top floor of the embassy that captures communications that are taking place nearby. Now, it's not a coincidence that U.S. embassies and consulates abroad tend to be not so far away from the parliament or presidential palace at the respective countries. In Germany, for example, you can literally throw a ball from the U.S. embassy to the main parliamentary building there. And so everything that is happening out of that embassy is not governed by FISA or the FISA Amendments Act. It's all executive order. And largely, they can do whatever they want as long as they're not focusing their massive surveillance apparatus on Americans. You know, it's not clear if that's going to change. I mean, the presidential NSA review board basically has a few words about maybe whether we should be respecting the privacy rights of Europeans and others, but it's not grounded in sort of a human rights context. It's more, hey, if we don't respect these people's privacy a little bit, they won't use U.S. companies for their communications, and then our economy will take a hit. And there's also, some language about, well, hey, maybe we should think about whether we want to spy on foreign leaders, at least when the risk of that spying, becoming public can have significant foreign policy consequences. I actually don't see much in either in the review proposals that have been made public that would significantly limit the NSA's spying, particularly the stuff involving foreign collection. And then so the part that is the most interesting to me as a computer geek is the part that is least interesting to people in sort of the general public sphere, which is the news that the NSA has been secretly collaborating with technology companies to weaken the security of their products. So one of the biggest names in the computer security industry, a company called RSA, reportedly took $10 million to weaken the security of one of their products that is used in commercial products around the world, in ATM machines, and I mean, just everywhere. And NSA apparently has a fairly large program that is intended to do this, either by bribing companies, by bribing engineers, by blackmailing people. I mean, however they can do it, they are trying to insert flaws in products because, in 1943, the Germans had their own special secret code machine, the Enigma machine, and the Japanese had their own special machine. In 2014, terrorists and pedophiles and drug dealers and spies are using the same laptops and phones as the rest of us. There's no Al-Qaeda phone and there's no Colombian drug cartel laptop. They all use MacBooks and iPhones like everyone else. And so what that means then is for the NSA to spy on Angela Merkel's calls, they want to get in her phone, and she probably has the same phone as you. And that means they want to insert flaws in her phone. And I think that is really fundamentally a threat to the cybersecurity of this country and to our economy. That hasn't gotten as much press as it should, and that's largely, I think, because it's really nerdy. But I think it's actually one of the biggest issues. All right, so that was the first one.
Second is dirty tricks, whether government already has
capacity. The Chris Christie thing. So of the revelations, that was the thing that has come out that is the most threatening to democracy was a Huffington Post article revealing that NSA had targeted people who they thought were sort of high-profile dissidents, or not dissidents, influencers, people who were not themselves engaged in violent acts but were sort of influencing others in ways that were a threat to the United States. And then the NSA was proposing to, I don't know if it was proposing or about to use information about these people that was negative to discredit them. And the information they were planning on using was information about their online dating habits and their viewing of internet pornography. That's getting really, really close to a dangerous line. I think actually it's gone far over that line. But once the government is in the business of monitoring which pornography people look at and making it public in order to discredit them, then it's really just a debate about who they're going to use it against. I think that is a step too far. But that's the kind of those are the kinds of things that are possible when you have a database of every web page that everyone in the world has looked at, of every Google search query that everyone has looked at. Remember, Google knows more about you than your spouse or your psychiatrist or your doctor. Before you are sick and call up your doctor, you're Googling for terms, right? You're like, does this mean I have cancer or do I just have a cold? You're trying to figure that out. When you are unhappy in your relationship, Google knows about it before you take any action. And so the fact that the government can get an insight to that and might use it to their advantage, I think is truly terrifying. And again, you may trust the president that we have right now, but you know, what if Chris Christie becomes the next president? I think the only sort of saving grace here is that the governor of New Jersey didn't in fact have access to a massive surveillance database, but the president does. Mm-hmm. All right, and then the third question was.
Well, just about these tools. Remember the Fuzzbusters of the past where...
So don't you draw attention to yourself by using these tools? Yes, you do draw attention to yourself, but you raise the cost of surveillance. Mm-hmm. So right now, the marginal cost of listening to one more phone call or reading one more email is basically nothing. The only thing stopping them from looking at your email is whether they want to do it or not. If you encrypt your communications, even if they have a way of breaking them, they're going to have to spend resources to do it. If enough people use these tools, then they don't have the resources to break everyone's communications. And so really what it comes down to is I want you all as my human shield to protect my communications. They don't have the resources to break every single encrypted communication. What that also means then is that you cannot just use encryption for the important things. When you're calling your spouse and asking them to stop off on the way home and get some milk, that needs to be encrypted. Mm-hmm. Because if you're only encrypting the important things, you're broadcasting, this is a really important communication, break this. And so the mundane has to be encrypted too. Do I think that they have broken those tools that I mentioned? Probably not. It is likely that NSA employs more mathematicians than any other entity in the world. They likely have an edge over the academic cryptography community, but I don't think they are miles and miles ahead. And certainly by using those tools, you make life a lot more difficult for them. If you are a high-profile target, they're going to get what they want. Whether they have to hack into your computer or phone, to install a bug, whether they have to break into your house when you're not there and install a microphone in your desk. They'll find a way in. The real question is it cheap? And to how many people can they do it at once? And targeted surveillance, the black bag jobs of the 70s, they don't scale. They can only break into so many houses. They only have so many agents working for them. But right now, they can get every single email that goes over AT&T's network. And so the goal here is to raise the cost of surveillance so that dragnet surveillance becomes too expensive for them to do anymore.
Thank you. Sandy.
Hi there. I wonder, do you think that China and Russia have read Snowden's laptops?
I think there are two questions there. One is, does he have anything of value on his laptops? And then the second is, have they read what he has on his laptops? Snowden has told journalists, including Bart Gellman, that he doesn't have anything of value on his computer. So even if the Russians or the Chinese or the Israelis or someone else were to hack into his computer or seize them, there wouldn't be anything to take. That seems like a reasonable approach on his part. Were I in his shoes, and I were flying into Russia with that kind of attractive database, I probably wouldn't have that information on my laptops either. Do I think that he has some way of getting access to that information? Maybe. But I doubt that he has it in his room, whether under lock and key or not. I think the smart thing for him would not be to have that information on any computers. Were I in his shoes, those laptops would be packed with as many movies and TV shows as possible because he's going to be sitting there for a while. I hope that he has a very large collection of books. That's what I would expect to be on those computers, not a gigantic cache of classified documents.
So how do you think he got the classified documents out of Greenwald?
I think he probably had them when he met with the journalists, but it's important to note that every single story that has come out since Snowden's name first became public came out because of the journalists publishing the information. I think what seems to have happened, and I have imperfect information here, I have the same information as the rest of you, but I think what happened is he gave a cache of documents to several journalists, Bart Gellman, Laura Poitras, and Glenn Greenwald, and then those journalists then started pouring through the documents and writing stories. It doesn't seem like there have been any subsequent leaks by Snowden. It seems like these journalists got a gigantic pile of documents, many of them written in a combination of intelligence speak and geek speak, and have spent months trying to decipher them and turn them into stories that can be presented to the public. Yes, Greenwald and Poitras have partnered with news organizations around the world in order to get stories to the front page of the newspapers where they will have the most impact. But it doesn't seem like Snowden has been reaching out to Der Spiegel or to Le Monde or whatever the papers in the respective countries. It seems like it's been the Greenwalds and the Poitras who have been working with the respective papers around the world. That's at least my impression of what's happened based on the information that has been made public and my conversations with several of the journalists who are working on these stories.
Can I ask a question as far as the encryption, as far as like private citizens outside, encrypting their communications? Because it seems like the government's going to have, more and more raw computing power at its disposal, Moore's Law and all of that. And it seems like there will be kind of a certain point where they can just throw so much computing power at everyone that sort of any sort of protections we take outside of, actual laws regulating surveillance or other sort of actions are kind of going to kind of be meaningless. But that's me not being a technologist saying that. So is that sort of true, or is there always going to be this back and forth between private companies and private individuals and the government because the same sort of technology fixes are available to both?
So for those of you who don't know, Moore's Law is this concept that the speed of computers, of computer chips, doubles every 18 months. And so just computers get faster and cheaper. So Moore's Law benefits both sides. It benefits the government, but it benefits us. So the extent to which you can encrypt your data, doubles every 18 months as well. I think that A world in which everyone is encrypting their communication is a world that terrifies intelligence services around the world. They've had it really easy for a while. Even if they have a way to break some kinds of encryption, they don't have a way to do that at scale. It would be difficult to imagine that. And look, even if they had to spend 5 minutes per email, that's a lot of work when you want to scan a billion emails a day. It's a lot of work. The one place where Moore's Law is a gigantic pain in the butt is cell phones. So the issue there isn't so much the advancement of the government, but so many of you may have a PIN number or password on your cell phone, and that is used to encrypt the data that's stored on your device, but it also is used to unlock your phone. So if someone finds your phone, you leave it in a taxi or what have you, they cannot get in and see what's on there. So we enter our PIN numbers into our phones 20 or 30 times a day. Every time you want to make a call, every time you want to check your email, every time you want to look up something on Google Maps, you have to enter your PIN number into your phone. And so there's a natural sort of upper limit to how long your PIN number or password is going to be, because you don't want to enter a 30-character password every time you want to make a phone call. Realistically, most people have 4 or 6-digit PIN numbers, and those can be cracked in about 2 or 3 minutes using off-the-shelf software. That's not so much the development of Moore's Law. You could probably do that 5 years ago. It's more the fact that we have really, really crappy passwords on our mobile devices because we're using touchscreens and because we're unlocking them so frequently. There are a number of companies and researchers that are looking to replace the password because it's just not very good. Passwords are, we're getting to the point now that the kind of password that you can remember can be cracked with off-the-shelf computing hardware. Particularly because people don't have 14-character random passwords. People have, you know, 1 or 2 words that are in the dictionary, and so the password that you have is not as strong as the length of characters might indicate, because in fact what you do when you're cracking a password is you run it through an English dictionary, and most people think that they're really smart because they like swap out the O with a zero or the A with an at sign, and don't worry, there are algorithms that can predict that. Or people take a word and they add a number 1 to the end of it, right? Like all of the tricks that you have when the website says you have to have a combination of letters and numbers, we're on to you. And so it turns out that password cracking is remarkably effective. People generally choose really bad passwords. And then on top of that, you have so many websites that you have to enter passwords that typically the same password that you use for one site, you use for another. And so once one website has been hacked, then all of your other accounts have been accessed. And so we really, really need to get away from passwords. But passwords are the things that control your encryption. So that is largely the weakest link. Luckily, real-time encrypted communication services like voice and text messaging don't involve passwords. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but if you use one of these applications, you try them out. Redfone is really fun to use. The way you authenticate yourself with the other person, the way you prove that you are talking to the other person and that no one else is listening in, is by using your voice. You recognize the other person's voice, and then you read out 2 words that show up on the screen. So it doesn't involve password. You don't pick any password yourself. You just make the call, and if you recognize the voice of your colleague or your lover or whatever, then you know you're kosher as long as the 2 random words that appear on their screen also appear on your screen. There are some really cool innovations happening in this space, but anything that is rooted in a password is fundamentally rather weak. I've gotten to the point now that I won't keep anything sensitive on a mobile device because I don't think I can keep it safe if the government seizes it. There is software that can be used at the border by customs or by the police that will extract everything off of a mobile device. And I'm getting really worried about my laptop, even though I have a 20-character password. That's probably more than you wanted to know about passwords, but that's good stuff.
I wanted to ask, what is the best case scenario that we can hope for, either from a legislative or a technological standpoint? Like, what if we accept that most people are not going to encrypt their own stuff, if we accept that people are always going to want free technology, what can we ask Google for? What can we, or alternatively, what can we ask, like, the government for?
So most people are their own IT department. They are their own chief information officer. There's a CIO and or a CTO at this organization who's in charge of setting, he or she, are you in the room?
Yeah.
Hi. She's in charge of setting policies, right? So if I don't know what your password policy here is, but if you're required to change your password every 3 months, that's why.
There has to be a capital, there has to be a functional
right.
letter.
But
it has to be at least 8 characters long.
So you have a professional setting rules for your organization. If you have antivirus software pre-installed on your work laptop or desktop, it's because the IT department sets that rule and forces it and pushes it out. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to go to a website and download it. It's just there. But at an individual level, you don't have a professional who's taking care of you. You are your own CIO, and you're probably not very good at it. Right? But that's okay, because you're not expected to do that. You are subject matter experts in your own area. You have your own worlds and own troubles to deal with. You shouldn't have to be. But that, in fact, is what you're stuck being. You're stuck being your own tech support help desk and chief security officer, too. And so any system that requires that you seek out the tools and educate yourself about the tools and then install the tools is hopeless. You just don't have the time or resources to do that because you have other things going on in your life that are more important. I mean, if it's like a matter of life and death, then maybe you'll do it. But because the threat is sort of obscure and hidden and the harms are several years down the road, if they exist at all, most people are rationally not going to invest those time and resources into it. And it's for that reason that I spend most of my time harassing companies. Right, so in January of 2010, when Google made the decision to turn on encryption by default, it didn't require any action on the part of the user. Just one day, you logged into your email account, and suddenly your email was encrypted. And yesterday, when Yahoo users logged in, suddenly they were protected in a way that they had not been protected the day before. And it's because of that that people like me, people in my community, spend so much time harassing and bullying companies, because if we can get the companies to deploy these security technologies in a way that doesn't require interaction by the customer, in a way that doesn't require that you take steps to learn about it and to turn it on, then everyone wins, right? So as another example, this is an Android phone. This is made using an operating system provided by Google. The Android operating system does not encrypt data on it by default. What that means is if someone finds my phone in a taxi, they can, and I don't have a PIN number or password, they can extract the data off the device. Even if I have a PIN or a password in some cases, they might still be able to extract the data off of the device because my phone from the factory doesn't include disk encryption. Now, I know what I'm doing, so I took the time to learn how to turn on the disk encryption. Apple's iOS operating system, the iPhone operating system, encrypts data by default. If you have a PIN number on your iOS device, everything's encrypted. No one's getting anything off of there if they find it, unless they break your PIN, which the government can do, but the random person who finds your phone probably cannot. Pressuring Google to turn on encryption by default for Android, if we're successful, will have a pretty big impact on the security of those users and shouldn't require any action, because you buy a new phone, you customize it, it's done for you. So I tend to focus on that road. I think generally that education is a bit of a waste. I know that there are people in this room who work on certain areas where, you know, safe sex education is probably a good thing. I tend to think that in the area of computer security and anti-surveillance, education is a waste. I think it's better to spend those resources pressuring the companies and entities that influence and design the technology that we use to build their products to be as safe and secure as possible. And the real problem there is that the kinds of technologies that would keep our data safe from the government also make it very difficult for advertising companies to make money. And, you know, the Googles and Facebooks of the world give us services for free. And, you know, if you're asking them to really secure your information, you're also asking them to give up money. And that's a tougher fight. And that's one of the reasons why the only security technologies these companies have deployed so far have been ones that still let them make money. And that's going to be an uphill struggle.
Since Google knows so much information about us, do you expect any of this future legislation to restrict what tech companies collect?
So Google is now reportedly spending more on lobbying than most defense companies and telephone companies. Google is spending an awful lot of money lobbying in Washington, D.C. You know, sort of the general progression of technology companies is they get beaten around by someone in Washington, and then they quickly open up an office, and then they staff the office, and they hire, in Google's case, a former member of Congress, a congresswoman, to be their head of their office, and then they start spreading the money around, you know, with donations and that kind of thing. You know, it is unlikely that any kind of... So the first thing is, there's unlikely to be any kind of consumer privacy legislation happening anytime soon. And the only reform of the surveillance stuff will be done in a way that maybe limits what the NSA can do, but it is almost 100% likely to not touch the tech companies. There's not enough political power in D.C. to overcome a major lobbying push by the tech companies. I mean, it's just too difficult. I mean, as it is, just getting something that the NSA doesn't want passed is really, really difficult. But if the NSA and Google are aligned on the same issue, it's not happening.
Do you think that Yahoo and Google and Facebook will fight back against this global data? Like, I read articles where they're saying this is terrible and we're against it, and then I read other things that make me think they're as willing to give this as anyone.
So the big tech companies put out an open letter to governments, including, a full-page ad in the New York Times in December, and they set up a website called reformgovernmentsurveillance.com. Where they, you know, complain about this stuff to politicians. They've asked for an end to dragnet surveillance,
right. But
they've made it quite clear that they're okay with targeted surveillance. So they are not committing themselves to move to a system where they're never able to hand over their customers' information. They just want to receive individual court orders about individual users. So they're not anti-surveillance companies. You know, I think... The companies are, you know, worried that the revelations that the U.S. government is vacuuming up hundreds of millions of their customers' information is pretty bad for business in countries outside the United States, right? So the statement by U.S. officials that "don't worry, we're not spying on Americans" doesn't really, you know, go over too well in Brussels. And so I think the Googles and Amazons and Facebooks of the world are seriously concerned about that, because not from a human rights perspective, but from a business perspective. You know, and so I think if we get any reform of spying on foreigners stuff, you know, there'll be at least some public statements to the effect that we will, you know, we will work with foreign governments when we can, or something like that, simply to sort of soothe the fears.
I have three, but they're quick, I promise. Okay. The first one is...
How about you ask them one at a time?
Yes.
Because otherwise I will forget them.
I'm with you.
Okay.
I do that. The first one is, what are the rules and regulations that individuals at the NSA are allowed to or have to follow when searching for this information? I assume that they can't just be like, well, I'm going to spy on my wife, or I'm going to spy on my neighbor. That's a giant assumption.
There are different rules depending on whether the person whose information they're looking up is a foreigner or an American. And they're not supposed to target Americans unless they meet a fairly high standard. But there are loopholes in this. So they can target the communications of a foreigner who's communicating with an American, and then the American's information ends up in their database. It can be searched through later. You know, I'm not a lawyer. I'm an activist computer scientist. So I can't tell you the specific details of the how FISA governs when they search and how they search, particularly because a lot of what NSA is doing involves reinterpretations of the statutes, previously secret reinterpretations of the statutes by the FISA court. A lot of the rules that have been imposed sort of by the courts as opposed to by Congress. And then there may be additional internal rules established by the NSA's internal surveillance oversight apparatus. But at a general level, the rules they're supposed to follow have tight controls for Americans and very lax controls for foreigners.
Second question, because you are a techie nerd, I sympathize, and you probably have some idea on what the government is allowed to prosecute on if they can see everything that you're saying and doing, but they probably can't act on it. I don't know.
So the NSA is not a law enforcement agency. They're an intelligence agency, and so they're not supposed to prosecute anyone with this information unless there's a process they can go through whereby they can introduce foreign intelligence information into court cases, but they have to tell you that they're introducing this. Turns out they weren't doing this for a while, even though they promised the Supreme Court they were doing this, and they just started late last year telling criminal defendants, oh, by the way, some of the information we use in this case came from secret surveillance intercepts. One of the problems with telling someone that this information came from foreign intelligence or even introducing foreign intelligence surveillance into a case is that it can reveal the sources and methods of the surveillance. So if you are talking to your colleague via Skype and then you get prosecuted and the Skype conversation gets introduced in the case, well, hang on a minute, I thought that Skype was encrypted. I guess the government can listen to Skype calls. And so there is a general reluctance on the part of the intelligence apparatus to allow the fruits of their intelligence to ever come out into the open because they don't want to reveal what they're capable of getting.
There's no scenario that you can imagine which discovery, just in the process of a criminal trial, discovery could just pry open some of those archives. Presumably national security would be invoked in this story.
Right, so we learned in the fall of last year that there's a process called parallel construction whereby the NSA was providing information to the DEA. There was so domestic information. They basically the NSA would tell the DEA, "Hey, you should go to this parking lot at 2 a.m. and see what you find, and don't tell us that don't tell anyone that we told you this. Just find another reason of saying that you were in the area." And so they were providing a steady stream of tips to the DEA, but they instructed the DEA to keep the existence of the tips out of the cases. And so the parallel construction was the process of creating this alternate excuse for how they came across this information. That's super, super sketchy. So there's actually a case out in California right now, a massive drug conspiracy case, where with uncanny ability, the DEA kept figuring out the burner cell phones that people were switching to. No one knows how, but like the minute people switched, suddenly they were on the new phone. Thank you.
Sure.
And so the defendants in that case are saying, hey, so what's going on here? Were you, in fact, getting help under this program?
Did you have a third, or was that number three?
I'm sort of curious if we found out anything about these private corporations through this NSA investigation, like what companies may be selling to other companies, if anything new has risen.
No, the commercial sale of information is something that we've not learned anything about through this program. Separate to the national security and surveillance stuff, there's also just this thriving industry of companies trafficking and selling our information to other companies. There was a congressional hearing maybe a month ago about this industry. The companies, broadly speaking, are described as data brokers. So they sell databases about consumers. And, I mean, these companies are totally unregulated. There's a line, I think it's from one of the Marx brothers, where he complains that, you know, the soup tastes bad and there's not enough of it. Mm-hmm. Not only are they selling so much of our data, but they're selling it so cheaply as well. It's like pennies for names. And they have databases like, you know, confused seniors or seniors interested in low sugar diets that then sketchy marketers can buy and then, you know, try and prey on the weak and confused. The one sort of silver lining to that hearing was Pam Dixon, who's a privacy advocate, was testifying, and she mentioned that one of these data brokers actually sold a list of rape victims for pennies per name. A day after the hearing, the Wall Street Journal called the company up and said, "So, tell us about this list." And the company like quickly said, "Oh, we've stopped selling that list. You know, it was an internal demonstration prototype that we were never intended to actually sell." So the company like ran away from that as fast as they could. But there are just as many really horrible examples in that database. And I mean, this industry just isn't regulated at all. There are dozens of companies that operate in this space, and so many of them will let you voluntarily opt out, but you have to opt out of every single company, and then a new company pops up and you didn't know they exist. And the thing that is difficult to figure out in those cases is where they even got the data from in the first place, like which questionnaire you filled out at the drugstore that got sold to that company or I mean, this is the information they want to keep secret, because if you learned which company sold your data in the first place, you'd probably be pretty upset. We're slowly getting a bit more information in that space. I think one of the things that's missing right now is whether or not those data brokers are selling data to the NSA. And I would suspect the answer is yes. But we're waiting for that shoe to drop.
One more. Sort of curious about, you mentioned the State Department program that is sort of encouraging Redfone and so on. I'm assuming it's for their own use, although anyone else can use it as well. If you could just say a couple words about it.
Sure. So the Democracy, Rights, and Labor Program at State, DRL, has, I think, $2 or $3 million a year that they give out in Internet Freedom funding. So Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, made Internet Freedom a priority. And so State gives out money, and then separately the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is the umbrella above the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia, they give out money. So they fund the development of things like Tor, which is a tool that lets you browse the web anonymously. They funded the development of Redfone and TechSecure. They funded a secure operating system that goes on laptops. It doesn't save anything to the hard drive, so in case it gets hacked, you're in good shape. That's called Tails. And so there's a few million dollars a year there. Realistically, $2 or $3 million a year against NSA's, $10 billion budget is not really a fair game or fair fight. But not every government has $10 billion a year to spend on surveillance. And so the purpose of the DRL program is to fund these tools so that journalists and dissidents in other countries can have them. Radio Free Asia, for example, funds these so that their programming can be accessed by people in countries where the internet is filtered or otherwise surveilled.
Yes.
Maybe a somewhat out there question, but I'm just wondering. We talk about how legislation has not been able to keep up with technology, right? Which is Moore's Law. It's kind of impossible, right? But could we have and could we still ask technology companies to operate more like Hushmail, for example, with not allowing them to retain our information for so long? Is that realistic? Is that possible?
So the law, the U.S. law that governs law enforcement access to email, not the spies, not the intelligence community, but just the police. When can the local sheriff in your town get your email? That law is called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and it was written in 1986. That was the last time Congress updated our privacy laws relating to law enforcement surveillance of electronic communications. That law does not include the word location, doesn't include the word social network. Congress moves really slowly, and that was even before they got as dysfunctional as they are now, right? Congress isn't going to update our privacy laws for a while, not because of the pushback by law enforcement, just because they can barely do anything right now. I'm a disillusioned DC resident, so I see what happens there, but it's unlikely we're going to get any kind of legal reform anytime soon. Even if everyone wanted it to happen, it's just things move really, really slowly right now. You have this separate problem, and I'm biased here, but I think it's really important for policymakers to hear from technical experts. I worked for the Federal Trade Commission for a year between 2009 and 2010. I worked on investigations of Facebook, of Twitter, of MySpace, and a few other big tech companies, and having a technologist there changed the way that the FTC did business. After they hired me, they hired one of my friends, and then they subsequently hired a chief technologist, and now they have a very senior computer science professor rotate through once a year. The current professor, LaTanya Sweeney, she's one of the best people in the country on anonymization of databases. She's, I mean, really an amazing person, and I'm really glad the FTC had the insight and courage to continue to bring in smart people like that. But the FTC is sort of alone in that path. The committees in Congress that have oversight over the technology industry don't have any staffers who are technical. You know, the way it works in DC is the committees in Congress pay such low wages that, you know, congressional committees are largely staffed by 25-year-olds who were, you know, living in six-person houses until they can build up a resume sufficient enough to then go and work in private industry. You know, you don't get subject matter experts there. You get political science graduates who are, you know, living on the credit card debt or mommy or daddy's money until they can, strike out on their own. And so, you know, it's not surprising then that Congress has a tough time keeping up when they don't have any experts working for them there. I think, you know, it's not surprising that the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, has been kept such in the dark about what the NSA is doing. They've acknowledged that they have no real way to know what the NSA is doing. They have to rely on the NSA to be forthcoming with it because they also don't have any technical experts working for it. The intelligence committees don't have any technical experts. You know, our entire policy-making process is largely blind when it comes to technology, but it wasn't always this case. Now, there used to be a Congressional Office of Science and Technology. I think it was called the Office of Technology Assessment, and Newt Gingrich killed it in the Republican Revolution in the mid-90s. He said that the $50 million a year that they had was a waste of money. He didn't. And they produced nonpartisan scientific reports for Congress. You know, if Congress wanted to learn about a particular issue, they would write something up and explain it in English. And I think that was a really stupid thing to do. And now, I mean, Congress has a really, really tough time with anything technical. I mean, it produces great fodder for Jon Stewart, but it's really sort of sad. You know, to your question about will companies voluntarily do things, not until they think they can make money doing so. But the dominant business model right now is of an advertising-supported one, and, you know, companies, the big billion-dollar companies, make money by mining data. And until companies can make money by protecting privacy, you know, that trend is going to continue. And particularly because there are so many companies that don't have direct business relationships with consumers that mine data, there's not even any way that consumers can pressure those, right? So even if you are using a Hushmail or a company like that, there's still going to be a data broker out there that is mining all of the information they can get from public records and from other sources. And, you know, really we need regulation. But we're unlikely to get it. Sorry.
Cindy.
Hi. Thanks. I wonder what you can tell us about how things work in other countries. What other democratic countries have mass surveillance? And Google, Yahoo, are their servers in those countries encrypted also?
So the U.S. is one of the few Western countries to not have a privacy regulator. So many other countries have an information commissioner or a privacy commissioner who has jurisdiction over all privacy issues in the country. So, for example, one of the most outspoken and progressive privacy commissioners is a woman who, I think she just left office, Jennifer Stoddart, who was the Canadian privacy commissioner. In the same day, Stoddart would issue a critical statement about airport searches and Facebook, two completely separate issues. Both private sector and public sector surveillance. In the US, the closest thing we have is the Federal Trade Commission, which solely regulates the private sector, and even then, only portions of the private sector. So the telephone companies are not regulated by the FTC, the banks, the healthcare industry, airlines, all of those industries are regulated by other federal agencies who don't really have any expertise or interest in privacy. We don't have a privacy regulator in this country that governs and regulates government use of data. That's a problem. One of the reasons why we have this massive surveillance apparatus is because there's no one who regulates privacy. The closest we have is the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which just writes reports. They don't have regulatory power. And, you know, they didn't even exist until a couple years ago because President Obama hadn't nominated anyone for the board. So other countries have actual regulators who can investigate. Many of you may remember a few years ago there was a gigantic controversy around Google Street View. It turned out that the Google vehicles that were driving through the streets and photographing houses were also surreptitiously collecting Wi-Fi information, and not only recording the data about the Wi-Fi access points, but also recording all the communications that were nearby, and it's slurping up passwords and usernames and web browsing information. The only reason we knew about that, that ultimately led to class action lawsuits and inspector and attorney general investigations and multi-million dollar settlements in the United States. The only reason we know about that is because in Germany, the state data protection regulators collectively asked Google for Q&A, and they wanted to see the vehicles. They asked to be shown them. So Google brought one of the vehicles to some place. A bunch of German officials came and looked at them, and one of the German officials was poking around at the vehicle and said, "There's a place here for a hard drive. There's an empty spot here. What is here?" And the Google person said, it's a hard drive. And he said, "Well, what do you store on the hard drive?" And they said, the photographs of the houses. He said, "Well, I'd like to take a look at that. Can you provide my office with a copy of the hard drive?" And when Google's lawyers were in the process of responding to that inquiry, they said, they looked at it and said, oh, it looks like there's more on this disk than we thought. Had the Germans not asked that question, we never would have learned that what was going on. That really was a discovery by, they weren't even the German federal privacy commissioner, they were a state privacy commissioner. So that really speaks to the power of the European model. The Europeans tend to have more power, but they use it less, so they get smaller fines. But that's the approach there. In terms of, do Google and Yahoo encrypt their data in the European data centers? These companies generally use the same technology in their operations around the world, and so the connections between the Google data centers in Europe are encrypted with the data centers in the United States. The real question is, what happens when national laws collide, right? So if European countries have a law saying that Google can only provide data to governments under certain circumstances, and then the US government goes to Google and says, "We want this now, with less legal process," what does Google do? What do they do when the Europeans say, "Don't give the data," and the Americans say, "Give us the data"? And the answer to that, is that Google is a US company, and executives are in the United States, and so Google follows U.S. law. If you work in this space for a while, in the privacy space, eventually you get a favorite quote by Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, now chairman. He was asked at the World Economic Forum maybe 4 years ago by Rachel Maddow. She asked him why Google didn't do more to protect its customers from the government. And he said, there's a problem with expecting us to protect your data, and that's that the government has guns and we don't. We are a U.S. company, we follow U.S. law, there can be no other way. And as long as Google has the data in its possession, it can be forced to hand it over by the U.S. government, or in fact any government that can threaten to arrest its executives. And that's in fact what happened in Brazil a few years ago. Google was storing the data about Brazilian users in the United States. They didn't have any servers in Brazil. The Brazilian government said, "We want this data about some people who are doing some things they shouldn't be doing." Google said, "Sorry, we don't have any data here." And the Brazilian said, "That's fine. We'll arrest your advertising executives in Brazil until you give us the data." And so Google quickly handed the data over. But Google doesn't have an office in Syria, and they don't have an office in Iran. And so when the Iranian government goes to Google and demands data, Google says, "Get lost." Factor that influences when the companies say yes or no to any government is whether they have an office in that country. Not servers, but employees. Because the data can be accessed remotely. It's whether there's someone that can be coerced or threatened into handing something over.
So criminal penalties, it sounds, from your telling, routinely attach to the refusal to hand over the data. Almost never do they attach to the misuse of data that is promiscuously shared around in the German Google case, I guess there were no criminal penalties for those who were hoovering up data. I mean, maybe that's the most chilling takeaway of several from today, which is that the restraints on the misuse of this information are voluntary. They have to do with opportunity costs or other factors that could easily be overridden if a government prioritizes it. But rarely do criminal penalties ever result as arising from these cases.
So the CNIL, CNIL, which is the French Data Protection Authority, has been investigating Google for a privacy violation of some kind. I forget the details, but they announced yesterday that they're fining Google $150,000 for stalling an investigation for not responding. What's 150 grand to Google? It's nothing. That's how much money they spend on massages in one day. I wish I had 150 grand worth of massages, but Google was fined $22 million by the Federal Trade Commission a couple years ago for violating the privacy of U.S. consumers. But again, $22 million is a drop in the bucket to a multi-billion-dollar company like Google. And you know, these companies have the lobbying might to stall investigations, to lobby against expanded regulations, expanded finding authority. And ultimately, because these companies play such an essential role in surveillance, they can use that to their advantage. You know, the NSA is not going to let Google get shut down. They're not going to let AT&T or Verizon get fined for what they're doing, because they play a useful role.
Well, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you, I think, for this update. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you all.
And all of you.